Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Global roaming. We did try to stay weekly. The news said no. So 5 days a week it is. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doog, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live. This is David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal land. The other night in Sydney, Isaac Herzog, the President of Israel, told his audience about October the 7th, 2023. He said, "Hamas launched a savage war on Israel. Thousands of bloodthirsty jihadist terrorists swarmed into our sovereign state. The devastating trauma impacted every city, every community, every single family in the state of Israel. Every Israeli knows someone who was killed, abducted, wounded, or abused." Every word there is true. And he went on, "The Jewish Democratic State of Israel was fighting to defend itself in a war we did not choose." That's a statement that needs unpacking. I'm sure the president himself would agree that that vicious assault on October the 7th didn't come out of the blue. There's a long history here, much contested, which has lately been written by Julie Norman and Mayor Carter Hallward in their calm and succinct book, Gaza, the Dream and the Nightmare. Mayor Carter Hallward is Professor of Middle East Politics at Kennesaw State University in Georgia. And Julie Norman, who joins us now, is an Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at University College London and an Associate Fellow at Chatham House. Julie, welcome to Late Night Live.
Well, hello, David.
Julie, as I was saying, this is a history that has been written and rewritten. What were your ambitions for this version of the history of Gaza since the First World War?
You know, obviously everyone saw those horrific headlines on October 7th and then the news of what was starting in Gaza right after. And we actually started writing the book right then, when it became very clear that there needed to be some resource for people to access to see how did things get to this point. You know, what we saw playing out that week did not come from nowhere. There was a long history before that. And I think we wanted to emphasize also that what we saw unfolding was not inevitable. It was not a given that things would get to that point, that there were many points in history where there was a lot of potential for Gaza, where there was a lot of hope for Gaza. But throughout this last 100 years of history, that hope gradually got chipped away. The conflict obviously escalated as it went, and we got to the reality that we are at now. And it's important, I think, to understand today's reality since, but even up through today, you need that history to put all that in context. And we wanted to do that and also highlight Gazan voices throughout that history.
And there's a sense that I found pretty thrilling, actually, of getting back to basics.
Indeed. You know, I think when we are talking about this conflict, it's understandably extremely emotional for many people in the region, but also around the world. It's very easy to get caught up in the here and now of the moment, of the passions of the moment. And yet I think really going back and unpacking just the clear history, what was happening at different points in time that led us up to today in a way that we hoped would be very accessible for general readers, people who were not coming to this as Middle East experts, people who were just seeing what was happening and said, how can I understand this place a little bit better? Almost a mini biography of Gaza, if you will.
Julie, was there even a district called Gaza under Ottoman rule?
Well, you know, David, this is so interesting because what we think of as the Gaza Strip is actually a pretty new phenomenon in terms of being a chunk of land in the way that we see it on maps now. With that said, I would emphasize that Gaza City, the main urban center of Gaza, has existed for millennia. We see it referenced back in biblical times and in biblical texts. And we know that it was a really important trade post, a very important transit post for centuries. But the Gaza Strip itself as a territory really didn't become its own district until the British took over in that area under the Ottoman Empire, which existed obviously in this region before World War I. Gaza was a city, but it wasn't this separate district. And that became defined when the British took control of that territory after World War I in a slightly bigger shape and broader borders than we see it now. But that's when we first started seeing this actual area called district, including Gaza City, but extending down to that border with Egypt.
A prosperous city.
Indeed, extremely prosperous on the coast, surrounded by very abundant agricultural land, orchards. It was a place where people would travel to from the north, from cities like Beirut, from the south, from cities like Cairo. And it connected, I would say, the north and the south, but also the east and west. You'd have trade routes coming kind of across through the subcontinent. And a lot of that was passing through Gaza. So it was a very prosperous city, and it was kind of a hub, a center for a lot of Palestinian and Arab life at that time.
When it came to the creation of Israel, Gaza was designated Arab land. So there was a Jewish population in Gaza, but was it a significant population?
Yes. So I would say that, yes, there has been obviously a Jewish presence across much of the Middle East, including Gaza. But at the time that Israel and the region is entering Israel's war for independence, the majority of Jewish immigrants to what was then called Palestine, now Israel, were further north, were more in the areas of what we've now called Tel Aviv, areas like Haifa. So much so, David, that when the UN suggested their partition plan, it included those cities as part of a Jewish state, but did not include Gaza in that proposed plan because it was majority Palestinian, majority Arab, and didn't have these larger Jewish populations that similar to those that had settled in the north.
Did the Zionists want that strip? Did they want that land to be part of Israel?
Look, you know, I would say, you know, any movement that is establishing itself as a state is going to want to maximize its territory. So yes, that was certainly a hope and then part of an ambition in that war to claim that territory. But that is one place where Egypt at the time was able to hold that coastal strip. Israel expanded the territory that had been allotted to them in that UN partition plan in this war, but that did not include what we now would call the Gaza Strip, which remained defended and ultimately what we'd say administered by Egypt after that war.
This is the war of 1947-48.
Right. So this is the Nakba, the 1948 war, which Israel remembers as the War of Independence. Palestinians obviously remember as the Nakba, the catastrophe, where over 700,000 Palestinians at that time were expelled, forcibly displaced from their homes. And you know, David, you know, because Gaza was still considered in this more kind of Arab-allotted region, many, many refugees fled to Gaza, such that its population nearly tripled during that time, with so many displaced people from other parts of then Palestine, now Israel, trying to get someplace they thought would be safe. And that's one reason why, even up till today, Gaza's population is over 70% people who were either direct survivors of the Nakba or their descendants.
You write that the fact that most of Gaza was outside the proposed Jewish state proved to be a double-edged sword.
That's right. And I would say exactly for this reason. It was, on the one hand, during the war, it did not see the brunt of the fighting, the aggression that we saw in other parts of then Palestine, now Israel, as that war played out. At that time, again, a lot of the military action was outside Gaza. But the flip side of that is, because the military action was not in Gaza, it was a place that many people saw as safe. It was a place that many people fled, again, thinking they would just be there temporarily. There's the famous image of Palestinian refugees keeping their keys, going there, thinking they would be there for a few days, maybe a few weeks, while the war ran its course, and then they'd be going home. But most of those people became refugees for life.
Australia was one of the majority of nations that voted for Resolution 194, which guaranteed the right of return for Palestinian refugees. But this was never accepted by Israel?
That's right. So Resolution 194 enshrines this right of return for refugees, and it's one that many refugees in Gaza, as well as throughout the broader Palestinian diaspora, hold on to quite strongly as an indication of international law supporting that right. I would point out, David, at that time, Arab and Palestinian leaders were also wary of Resolution 194 because it required living in peace with one's neighbors and essentially acknowledging the presence of the new Jewish state, which many at the time were not willing to do. But since that, we have seen a very marked shift in how Palestinians and Arab leaders in particular speak to 194 and do embrace it readily now and see it as a real foundation point for allowing refugees, if not to physically return, at least to have some sort of reparation and acknowledgement.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Julie Norman about her book, Gaza, The Dream and the Nightmare. Julie, there's such fascinating detail here. So in 1948, there is Gaza. It's been occupied by the Egyptians, and it remains, what, for 20 years, a province of Egypt, essentially. But the UN is setting up its fundamental institutions. And this is when Anwar is set up to care for refugees. Tell us about the educational work of the UN at this time and the introduction of the American Quakers.
Yes, so this is a very interesting time period in Gaza's history that I think we often skip over when we're just focusing on the military events and the wars. But what happens in the immediate aftermath in Gaza is really crucial to, I would say, some of the cultural foundations for Gaza and for Palestine more broadly. And this is that very early into this war, pretty early into 1948, we actually see the American Friends Service Committee, or the Quakers, are sort of tasked by the new UN to assist with humanitarian services for refugees, for those who are displaced. The Quakers, interestingly, had been involved in some of the refugee services in Europe after World War II. And the Quakers are very intentional about trying to set up not just food aid or medical clinics, but also schools and an education system. And they open a system that is not only open to boys or to the elite, but really to everyone, to boys and girls, to anyone from any background. And that sort of lays the foundation for a very open access, democratic education system that exists to this day throughout many Palestinian refugee communities. And one reason for that is it's been carried on by this agency called UNRWA. UNRWA is a kind of a weird little acronym, but it stands for the UN Relief and Works Agency. And it was interestingly set up before what we now have is the High Commission for Refugees in the United Nations. Many people, I think, are aware the UN has a body that deals with refugee issues. That, David, this was so early in the UN's history that that agency did not exist when the Nakba happened. So we had this other agency set up then to help Palestinians. They took on a lot of the duties that had been started by the Quakers and essentially expanded and magnified those, and to this day continue to provide education and provide health services to refugees across Palestinian refugee camps in the Middle East, including Gaza. And it's one reason why, up until this day, Palestinian refugees are one of the most literate, most highly educated populations, and certainly displaced populations, because of this foundation from UNRWA and from the Quakers before that.
But of course, it's been shut down in Gaza now.
That is right. There has been extreme pressure and squeezing of UNRWA, particularly in Gaza. Their international staff in particular is not able to operate there. I would say, though, David, I was just in conversation with UNRWA officials this week. They are still able to provide a number of services in Gaza. Israel has been very strict in UNRWA's involvement in bringing goods in, bringing resources in. But in terms of delivering services on the ground, they have reopened schools, they have reopened clinics. I think they're servicing over 70,000 children now again in schools in Gaza, despite the still extremely difficult conditions on the ground.
In the 1950s, though, Gaza City found itself cut off from its hinterland. What was the impact of that on the economy?
Yes, so this period, again, in this between 1948 and 1967, what happens in Gaza changes its trajectory immensely. Again, remember, we were speaking about before the war, this was a very vibrant city, a very populous city, a place where people went to do business, et cetera. And after 1948, it has become a refuge point again for many displaced people through no fault of their own. But that very much overwhelms the economy there. It becomes a city that has to provide for many more people than it was before, again, at least twice, if not three times as many people. And at the same time, it's cut off suddenly from many of its old export routes, from many of its own travel routes, many that would have gone up to those cities that were just over the border of what is now Israel, going up to Jaffa, going up to Haifa, and now it doesn't have that access anymore. So we start immediately seeing a squeeze on Gaza economically at this time, and a lot of uncertainty as to how that will be recovered. Again, remember, Gaza is sort of in a limbo status now. It's not part of the new state of Israel, but it is not formally a part of Egypt either. Egypt administers it, but Gaza is sort of under Egyptian control in this time. And so there's a lot of stifling of that vibrancy and of that more kind of entrepreneurship that we had seen prior to the war.
Did Israel have to have a hard border between Gaza and its own territory, the old territory that that city had served? Did it have to be cut off, or was that just the realistic approach at that time?
You know, David, I think this is something that'll be debated for so long in history. And we do see this border change in its nature throughout the decades of being slightly more open or sealed shut, as we've seen it obviously in the last few decades. But I would say at this point, from Israel's perspective, they were the target of what we're calling at times Fedayeen attacks, of kind of cross-border raids by groups, individuals who were armed, who were trying to kind of challenge this new state of Israel. And so from Israel's point of view, it was necessary for security to have that hard border, to have that secure border, even though for many Palestinians, that land was still seen as their land. Their homes were still on the other side of that border. And so they saw that as much more legitimate freedom fighting, if you will. But that is one reason why that border became very militarized and very securitized from those early days.
How free were the Palestinians under Egyptian rule? Could they come and go from Gaza? Could they travel? Could they, be educated abroad? How open was the border to the rest of the world?
Yeah, this is a good question because obviously now we think of Gaza as being so cut off. And then even though Gaza was under Egyptian control, there was much more movement than there is now. People couldn't go north into Israel. And I would point out too, Egypt was not looking to take in a lot of Palestinian refugees either. So it was not just a free flow. But with that said, people could go to Egypt for education, for work, and people did do that. I think in our days now, David, we think about people just traveling everywhere. And of course, that was not a common reality for most people anywhere at that time to be, taking off for faraway places. But certainly people would access Cairo, would access Egypt, and there was much more of a flow than there is now.
In 1956, you quote in the book a statement of Moshe Dayan: "We mustn't flinch from the hatred that accompanies and fills the lives of hundreds of thousands of Arabs who live around us and are waiting for the moment when their hands may claim our blood." Is that, from that time, a fundamental of Israeli approach to Palestine? They hate us.
Yeah, you know, David, these quotes from Dayan that we share in the book are really interesting because it's from a speech where he acknowledges essentially the pain of Palestinian refugees. He says, "Let us not hurl blame at the murderers. Like, should we complain that they hate us?" And he recognizes where that comes from. And yet he also says, whatever the cause, we recognize this hatred. And he says, this is the choice of our lives to be ready and armed and strong and tough. For if we fail in this, our lives will be cut down. And I think we see this almost as a sort of foundation point for how we see a lot of Israeli security thinking a lot of the philosophy behind it, that even for people like Diane, who could see some of the reasons for why this conflict has persisted, this sense from Israel that one needs to be hypervigilant, that if we don't take action and strike back, even in intentionally disproportionate ways, then this will be the end of our state and the end of our people and survival. And again, coming obviously less than 10 years after the Holocaust. So that mentality, that way of thinking, I think was very much expressed in Diane's words, and it's one that we've seen expressed in the years since in Israel's actions.
In 1956, famously, Britain, France, and joined by Israel, attempted to seize the Suez Canal after it had been nationalised by Nasser. And in the Suez War, Gaza was taken by Israel. Very easily, you suggest, it was not much of a fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think people have heard about the Suez Crisis and the showdown with Britain and France and Egypt. But what happened in Gaza, I think, is sometimes overlooked. And for Gazans, this is actually considered the first occupation by Israel before the obviously much longer occupation to come. And you had asked before if Israel kind of wanted this strip of land. And the answer is that, you know, yes, that was very much still part of the hope and the intention to claim that territory. And that was more of Israel's interest in this war to expand that that land, that territory, whereas the Western states were, you know, mostly interested in the canal. So they engage in this joint operation. This time, Gaza falls very quickly. But the devastation on the ground for civilians, I think, you can really not be overstated. We estimate from records that around 1,000 people were killed. Many were detained or held during that time. A mass grave has been was unearthed in the Khan Yunis area some years after. And so this was an event that I think remember in kind of big power military battles. And yet on the ground for civilians, this was a terrifying episode, one that resulted in extreme violence right away and resulted in Israeli presence and, again, occupation in that region for over 4 months. Even after the troops were withdrawn, Israel maintained that presence there until they were ultimately withdrawn and Gaza went back to that very kind of uneasy Egyptian administration. But it showed, I think, what might be to come. And it was an indication that that this conflict was not over, that things were probably going to continue and get worse before they got better.
Why did Israel withdraw from Gaza at this point?
So I would point out at this point, you know, the U.S. is not quite as much of a strong ally as it is for Israel. And the U.S., and again, the relatively new U.N. at that point, push Israel to withdraw from the areas that they had that they had occupied during that period. And they establish a new UN peacekeeping force along that border as well. And so this is really where you see international actors kind of say, you know, we are going to step in and say this kind of occupation, this kind of takeover is not something that we're going to stand for. So we did see that pressure first from the internationals. And I would say, too, there were some calculations within Israel that, yes, Israel wanted that territory, but they really didn't want to absorb this huge population of Nakba refugees. And I would say this is a pattern that we'll see again in 1967 and arguably even up to today, where there is an interest in Israel to control territory, but you know, a very much a disinclination to absorb the Palestinian population and particularly the refugee population living there.
They wanted the land, they didn't want the people.
Yes, I think that's the best way to put it.
And nobody else wanted the people either. I mean, Egypt wasn't very keen on taking them.
That's exactly right. And this is, again, a pattern that we see replicated up till today, where despite the rhetoric of then-Arab leaders like Egyptian President Nasser, in reality, the Arab states and Egypt in particular did not want this big refugee flow either. They did not want a highly, you know, active Palestinian population coming into their country, their territory, and what they saw as being a potential political risk or risk for instability. And so there was lip service to the Palestinian cause, but really not an attempt to really help those civilians or help those refugees.
So that in a unique way, the Palestinians are a captive people.
I think that's a very fair way to say it. And especially at this time, again, people didn't know about what was going to come, obviously, in the years later. But at that point, you kind of had Palestinians stuck between wanting to go home to what was then Israel and being denied that and then being actively occupied by Israel in that war. And then the other hand, this Egyptian administration that many felt was also heavy-handed, did not have their best interests, and was certainly not, you know, looking for their liberation or independence at that time.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Julie Norman about her book, Gaza, The Dream and the Nightmare, which she co-authored with Maya Carter Hulwood. Now, Julie, Egypt's control of the Strip ends in 1967, when the 67 war is fought. And at this point, as you write, as we all know, Israel annexed East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights. But again, they did not annex either Gaza or the West Bank. Is it the same problem that Israel was facing? However much they might want the land, they didn't want the people.
Yes, I would say we see this same phenomenon replicated in the 1967 war, a war that I think is very well known for people who follow this conflict that sort of set up the borders that we know now and the occupied situation in the West Bank and Gaza. And I would say, David, you know, there were debates within the Israeli government at that time in what to do with the different territories occupied. Some wanted to annex them, but as you said, there was a decision to not take in the territories that were most populous. There was a consideration to use the territories for land for peace deals with Arab neighbors. That's what ends up happening with the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt, which is returned to Egypt under the Camp David Accords in response for restored relations. Or there was kind of also this just decision not to decide, so to speak, on the West Bank and Gaza, and sort of just to hold those territories where, again, Israel would have a sort of maximum control over the land, but would not be taking on the burden of what they would see as a burden of bringing in these Palestinian communities as citizens in Israel. And I would say that was for political considerations. They knew about this, this want for the right of return, this want to return, but also for their own demographic concerns. There was a consideration that exists up till this day that if Palestinian-Israeli communities were merged, Israel would cease to be a Jewish state relatively soon, that the Palestinian numbers would outnumber those of Israel.
Was it open to Israel at this point, the Egyptians having been turfed out, was it open to Israel to withdraw and allow a small, free country to exist on the Mediterranean coast?
In hindsight, I think we would see that option as one that would seem viable. And yet I would say at the time for Israel, this is still pretty early in their history. Again, it's about 20 years in. Their military has proved quite capable in the wars to date, but is still not the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, as we know it now in terms of their military strength. It was also the case that there was still ongoing threats from neighboring Arab states. And we see that in the 1973 war when there is an attack on Israel from both Syria and Egypt. And I would say the other consideration that changes at this period is the rise of the PLO, the rise of Fatah, which at that point was, it was an armed resistance faction. It was its dude, or it saw its strategy and tactic as, you know, carrying out armed resistance against Israel. So for Israel at that time to say, okay, you know, we feel safe, we feel ready to kind of have this neighboring Palestinian state with us or something like that, I think seriously was not realistic to them at that time, even though in hindsight we look back and say, oh, couldn't they just have done that then? It was a much more dire situation for them from an Israeli perspective in those years.
Yeah, nice idea, but...
Right.
Yeah. With Israel now controlling Gaza, West Bank, etc., etc., there is the growth of armed hostility to Israel from within these territories, which gives us the PLO. And what is the Israeli response to finding themselves the target of much more organized terrorist activity?
Yeah, I would say this is where we see a shift from sort of Israel fighting in interstate wars with Arab states and militaries where they prove to be quite quite capable, and fighting this PLO, this more integrated sort of force. Countries across the world find it much more difficult to carry out military operations against these non-state actors of this type. And we see this up through today and in many different conflicts. And for Israel, it was a struggle with how to target these PLO factions that often operated out of populated areas. It wasn't as easy as just kind of sending in an army, that we see that in later years. And so they did try and identify where those leaders were. There were certainly incursions into Gaza in the early 1970s to try and rout out some of those leaders. A lot of those incursions centered on refugee camps where Israel believed that a lot of the PLO organizing and mobilization was happening. So there were some of these efforts. But I would say, Dave, the PLO ends up operating mostly in this period from outside of the territories. Aside from some operations from within Gaza, their main training, their main leadership, their main action bases are first in Jordan and then later famously in Lebanon, as many listeners will remember. So the ability to kind of crack down on that within the territories was somewhat limited from the Israeli perspective.
Control of the Gaza Strip having moved from Egypt to Israel, what was life like for people living in Gaza? Did it change a great deal once Israel was the dominant power?
Yeah, so things changed very much in the post-1967 period. Again, Israel is the occupying power, which means it controls all elements of life. I mean, we think mostly about a military presence, but it was more the sense that there was control over the legal system, the medical system, how you got land, how you purchased things. Pretty much every facet of life had to go through Israeli authorities, and that's still very much the reality in many parts of the West Bank. Law was under Israeli military orders, under martial law. So it was very much a system of control from above in that regard. We also see the beginning of settlement expansion in both whether the West Bank and Gaza. So Israeli civilian presence as well as military presence, and gradual squeezing even more of the Palestinian economy that had existed up until then.
What about freedom of movement for Palestinians in Gaza?
Yeah, this is interesting, David, because I think we would assume that there was, a sealing of the borders and the strict checkpoints and stuff like we see now in the West Bank. And certainly there were some border restrictions, but the flow was much more open than it is today. In fact, there was an approach from Israel at this time, and again, this itself was debated, but to sort of enable Palestinian labor to come and work in Israel. So this was seen as kind of a way to sort of placate the Palestinian population, give some people, jobs and some sort of income, while also using it to the advantage of building up the Israeli state even further. So again, there are many problematics to that arrangement, which we may talk about. But the idea behind that we saw on the ground was that you'd have thousands of people each day who would essentially take small buses from Gaza into Israel, would wait essentially at certain junctions, certain intersections to be picked up for manual labor jobs, for construction jobs, work in factories, things like that for the day, would try and get some kind of wage, and then would take these buses and services back to Gaza. So that was a very common labor situation. Palestinians found it very demeaning and demoralizing to have to work as wage laborers on what was often literally their families or their ancestors' land. So there was a lot of pain and grievance, but there was just a very different type of movement flow, I think, than we would imagine today.
Julie, let's pause at this point where in the early 1970s, the Yom Kippur War is just over the horizon. And let me ask you this. Of the argument you have advanced so far, what would Israeli historians, politicians most challenge you about?
Yeah, you know, I did in my book speak with many Israelis as well, and so I was directly challenged on some things. And I would say that there is challenging to the accounts first of 1948, of course, and the fact that Palestinians were expelled from their homes. Some do challenge that narrative.
That's still denied, is it?
Yes, I would say, you know, there has been a lot of historians who've done such important work on this from inside Israel, Benny Morris, among others, who have really gone into the newly opened archives in recent years and decades and shown that, in fact, there was that expulsion and forced displacement. But many do doubt that narrative, and they doubt the intentions, I guess you can say, of the refugees as being a displaced people wanting to go home, and I think read much more militancy into that, into the strip from the start, which again, my conversations with Gazans, my time in the region, you know, that certainly was not like endemic or a given to the area. And, you know, again, I would say too, this, the way that we read, that many would read, Palestinian actions during this time as trying to get back to their homes, Israel saw as a threat to their existence and indeed for many as a threat to the Jewish people. So, you know, we can discuss these things as, you know, as armed conflicts, as certain periods. But for many Israelis at that time, that was seen as existential threat. For example, the 1967 war, many saw that as an existential threat. So any point in this history, David, I could say there's challenges from different points of view. And we do try and bring some of that point of view into the book so that readers are aware of the different ways that this conflict
yes.
is perceived by different actors.
It's something I enjoyed very much in the book. The next existential threat is, you know, just over the horizon, as I said, the Yom Kippur War. The upshot of this is the Camp David Accords, or am I just eliding much too much detail when I just link those two directly?
You know, David, I don't think it's idealistic or naive to say that. And I think a lot of us reading history almost take a little bit of hope from that when things seem at their lowest, yet another war, another bloody conflict, like can that actually be an inflection point that then motivate some kind of change for a new type of thinking or a new type of peace process. And certainly many of us are reading this current moment to see, you know, is this something that can lead to something better? Or are we just on a full downward decline? But certainly in the 1970s, yes, the Yom Kippur War happens in 1973. It starts with a surprise attack on Israel by Egypt and Syria that is initially actually quite successful. Israel is taken by surprise. But ultimately does kind of recover and is successful in that war as well in pushing back those states. But what it does do is it sort of brings international attention to this conflict in a different way, certainly brings U.S. investment and attention to the conflict. And I think also just for the actors themselves, for Israel in particular, and at this point for Egypt, this sense that we can't just keep having these, you know, armistice and ceasefires that then flare up again in 5 or 10 years. We need to actually consider some sort of peace agreement. And you see very brave moves by the leaders at that time. The Egyptian president, Anwar Sadat, goes and speaks at the Israeli Knesset, a move that would have been unthinkable, you know, essentially days before he did it. So these real gestures of saying we're ready for something different. And the U.S. does broker that Egyptian-Israeli peace agreement at Camp David in 1979. That is, I would say, probably the most successful peace agreement, if you will, that has come out of this conflict and the one that has essentially survived and maintained up until this day.
Now, I'm going to jump forward a little bit because I want to get to the formation of Hamas. But the formation of Hamas is on the other side of the First Intifada, which, you write, is remembered by Palestinians as a really wonderful time.
The Intifada, and I would again say for Palestinians, this is usually means uprising. You know, in Arabic, it translates as like shaking off or waking up, but it's the idea of an uprising. And I know that word has many different connotations in different communities, but that's the way it was always said to me in the territories, and it's the way we use it in the book. And yes, the first Intifada, you know, a lot of community-based resistance of people, women, men, young people, older people, religious people, secular people, you know, a lot of people in this kind of mass social movement, if you will, or political movement saying, like, we want a different future and we want to have a say in what's going to happen. And, you know, people were doing demonstrations, doing strikes, and a real sense of just community solidarity across Palestine, across the Palestinian people at this time that people remember with a lot of nostalgia. And this was in the Strip, it was in the West Bank. But as you said, you know, this type of community activism is the core of the Intifada, but we start seeing other groups emerge in this time as well. And one is Hamas, which becomes a sort of a minor actor in that Intifada, but then gains ground very quickly as we go into the 90s and the Oslo period.
You make really clear that the formation of Hamas is in large part impatience with the kind of religious opposition to Israel, which had been peaceful, the notion of a more active Muslim faith across the nation, across the region. But Hamas was both religious and violent.
That's right. You know, there was a long presence in Gaza, in Palestine before of an Islamic presence. It was mostly led by the Muslim Brotherhood, which people may have be familiar with that group. But intentionally, you know, very apolitical, David, and very opposed to getting involved in the national resistance, the liberation movements under the PLO, that was mostly secular groups leading those. And the Muslim Brotherhood kind of said, look, we're focused on establishing Islamic society. We're not kind of getting into this Palestinian statehood struggle that, these other groups are so focused on. But that changes in this Intifada in the late 1980s, where a certain segment of that group's, of the Muslim Brotherhood says, you know, we can't sit this out anymore. We are on the back foot if we just keep, you know, saying that we're not political. And so they form this offshoot of Hamas, get involved first in the Intifada, and then pretty quickly into the 1990s start taking on this mantle of armed resistance as kind of their raison d'etre at that point, and start pretty early with the suicide attacks, the suicide bombings that became so well-known and horrific in the second Intifada. But those start in the 90s with targeting different sites in Israel.
In the meantime, more and more Israeli settlers are pouring into Gaza.
That's right. The settlement issue, I think people are aware, these are Israeli communities, towns, et cetera, that are set up within the occupied territories, most in the West Bank. But at that time, there were about 21 that were built in Gaza with about 9,000 Israeli residents. And so that infrastructure is expanding as the settlements expand, checkpoints expand within the Strip. And so things within Gaza become a lot tighter, I would say, in terms of internal movement, in terms of internal flow, largely because of the settlement presence and the resultant military presence around them.
I had not realized until I read your book how shaky the Oslo Accords are about guarantees of statehood for Palestine. I kind of thought there was a solid promise there that there would be a two-state solution, but it's pretty vague.
It is. And, you know, David, the Oslo Accords, which I think many listeners might remember, there was a lot of hope around them as this, you know, new peace agreement that would lead to a Palestinian state. But they were intentionally very vague in their wording. It refers to kind of a gradual autonomy for Palestine, and certainly an understanding from Palestinian negotiators that that would lead to full self-determination, but that that language of Palestinian statehood is not directly guaranteed in Oslo. Oslo was also set up as a series of kind of confidence-building measures that the tough issues would kind of be handled down the road in later negotiations, if trust was built in the earlier stages. And as we sadly know from that history, that trust was not built. Those later negotiations did not happen. And Oslo ends up unraveling, you know, in really less than a decade, kind of going into the 2000s.
There was also huge hope when Ariel Sharon ordered disengagement from Gaza and the withdrawal, highly contested, bitterly contested at the time, the withdrawal of what was 200,000 settlers from the Strip. You write of it, you write of the disengagement plan as really not offering Gaza much hope at all.
Yeah, the disengagement plan, this happens in 2005 when Israel withdraws the settlements from Gaza and withdraws the internal military presence from Gaza. And this is read so many different ways by different actors. I would say even at the time, Hamas certainly celebrated it as kind of a victory for them to kind of oust this internal Israeli presence. Many Gazans I spoke with said they saw it as a hopeful time. People were, you know, very happy to have the settlements gone, the checkpoints gone, things like this. And I would say in reality, though, you know, Israel still maintained control over all of Gaza's borders, all of its airspace, much of its sea space. So still, again, essentially controlled so much of what was able to happen in the Strip, even while not having that internal presence. So there's a debate to this day within Israel as to was Israel still occupying the Strip or not? The international community says yes. Many in Israel say no. But even within Israel, this move was contentious. Removing settlements is very politically contentious in Israel. This idea of seeing as kind of ceding the Gaza Strip was seen as controversial. And we look still at records from those times, and there are comments from Sharon's aides essentially saying that they knew this move would, quote unquote, like put the peace process into formaldehyde, like essentially freeze the peace process by Israel taking this unilateral move. It would get the U.S., get the international community off their back, show that they were kind of taking this move while also unloading the responsibility, so to speak, in Gaza, which had become quite quite burdensome. And, you know, and I would say also Israel saw it as a security threat, too, in the context of the Second Intifada, where, again, a lot of the armed resistance, a lot of the suicide bombing was coming not only from there, but partly from there.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, talking to Julie Norman about her book, Gaza, The Dream and the Nightmare. Julie, Hamas takes over the government of Gaza, elected, apparently quite sort of fairly elected, starts digging tunnels. Now, tell us about the tunnels. I don't think they're funny at all. But what I found surprising was that they began as commercial operations.
Absolutely. So, yes, Hamas ends up taking control of the Gaza Strip. They do, as you said, win the Palestinian elections freely and fairly, and there's a sort of power struggle between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas takes control over Gaza. But right, Hamas is in this territory now that has sealed borders. You know, that everything is, again, externally still controlled by Israel. And so they start relying very heavily on kind of an illicit economy, but an economy that is sourced mostly through underground tunnels from Gaza into Egypt. You know, I think people think about the tunnels now as used for military purposes, and over time that did happen, and it was starting to happen at that time too. But for many Gazans, the tunnels were actually the sort of economic lifeline. There were tunnels that smuggled everything from foodstuffs to automobiles to you know, people passing back and forth.
They got cars down the tunnels.
Oh yeah, I mean vehicles. Yes, I mean they were large. They were extremely notable infrastructure projects to have these, and they became more sophisticated over time with lighting and reinforcements and things like this. And what Hamas essentially does is sort of take control of this tunnel system. They systematize it. They set up a taxation system for goods that are coming through. And so Hamas actually gets much of their early revenue from this tunnel economy, if you will. And many Gazans get many of their resources and, you know, things that they need also through this tunnel economy, especially as Israel starts squeezing the amount of goods coming in through through more traditional channels.
At what point did Israel start subsidizing Hamas?
You know, this is something that obviously is very much in the news now with how much Israel was kind of working through Qatar to support Hamas. I would say that in the 2010s, there became more of a policy of containment with Hamas. And this was mostly under the Netanyahu governments, not completely. And the arrangement, and again, the U.S. was well aware of this too, was that Qatar, with Israeli and U.S. acknowledgement, would sort of support the Hamas government, give them funding that was literally often smuggled over the border and like overstuffed suitcases. This is not like made up. But this idea that that they would kind of be this middleman to support Hamas to run things in the Strip, and that Israel would kind of carry out incursions or operations when they felt the security situation was getting too risky. But those operations, as horrific as they were for civilians on the ground, people remember Cast Lead in 2008, Protective Edge 2014. From an Israeli perspective, these weren't meant to uproot Hamas as much as so much to contain them. So you had this sort of dual policy of allowing for their support from this well-funded external actor, while also carrying on these military incursions, but one that had more of a containment sort of strategy. And of course, that that proves we're unsuccessful. And as Netanyahu is very much criticized from the right, as well as from the left in Israel, largely because of that strategy that many people felt left that led to October 7th.
Let me go back to the words I quoted of President Herzog's delivered in Sydney the other night. The Jewish Democratic State of Israel was fighting, talking about October the 7th, of course, was fighting to defend itself in a war we did not choose. What do you think of that statement?
Yeah, you know, I would say Palestinians did not choose this war either, and they have also been in this cycle of violence that has affected both Palestinian and Israeli civilians now for over a century. And when we talk about the October 7th in particular, I do want to emphasize just the absolute like horrific nature of that day. I have visited those communities and talked to survivors there also, and that pain is extremely real. And I think any state would have responded to an attack of that kind with some kind of force. But what we saw in Gaza afterwards, again, for many was an amplification, a continuation of a war, of a reality that they felt they had been living under for quite a while, and that, of course, was unleashed in extreme proportions and that resulted in extreme horrific actions and realities for people on the ground there. So just to say, civilians have not chosen this war on either side. But yes, the trying to look at today's events without looking at these years, these decades of history, I think leaves us without a very important context for understanding where we are now.
Julie, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.
I've been talking to Julie Norman, Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at University College London, about the book she has written with Maya Carter-Halwood, Gaza, The Dream and the Nightmare, published by Polity. That's the show. On our next, we're talking to that delightful and provocative man, Steven Pinker, who's out in Australia to promote the notion that what drives society is not what we know, but what we know everyone else knows. Baffled? He makes sense of it. And we're looking at the power of memes in political debate. The power, that is, of jokes.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.